you on behalf of the Honors Program and the Strauss Center to our speakers, Judge Greenaway and Rabbi Reese, for taking the time out to come here. Judge Joseph Greenaway received his commission from President Obama as the 62nd jurist appointed to the United States Courts of Appeal for the Third Circuit on February 12, 2010. Previously, Judge Greenaway was a district judge in the District of New Jersey. Judge Greenaway earned his BA in history from Columbia College in 1978 and graduated from Harvard Law School in 1981. From 1982 until 1983, he worked as a law clerk for Judge Vincent Land Broderick of United States District Court of the Southern District of New York, and has previously worked at Kramer Levin. Rabbi Yonah Reese is the Av based in of the Chicago Rabbinical and Rosh Yeshivat Reese and a Chaver based in at the Beis Din of America. A Yadin Yadin Musmuth of Reese and an attorney who was an associate for 6 years at the national law firm of Cleary Gottlieb. Rabbi Reese is a graduate of Yale Law School where he served as senior editor of the Yale Law Journal. My name is Dina Levine, and as Dr. Rochtel mentioned, I teach here at Stern College. I'm also an early alumna of the Honors Program, and I am privileged to be here today. So if the speakers could come here, we have several questions, and at the end we will open it up if any of the students have questions. My first question is just really a background question so that the audience gets some flavor for you. I really want to know what circumstances made you want to become a judge or a dyad, and what part of your jobs do you most enjoy?
Very dangerous to give a microphone to a judge, but here we are, and it's so wonderful to see all of you. I didn't expect so many people. I thought I was going to just be speaking to her class, you know, 15, 20 people. Look at all this. So. Here's some good news and bad news. The good news is I did not give a moment's thought to becoming a judge at any point in my life until someone called me on the phone when I was about 36 years old and said, "Hey, your name has come up. Good things have been said. Do you want to be a federal judge?" I thought for what seemed like a long time, I think it was about a nanosecond, I said, yes. And actually, that's absolutely true. I think that many people who at your age or a little older set as a goal, "I want to be a federal judge," are really after fool's gold. It's, you know, try to think of being a good person, a good family person, a good lawyer, a good doctor, whatever it is that you are pursuing. I did not think about it, but I'm also quite glad that it happened.
Well, I guess similarly, I never really looked in the classified ads to decide that this was the profession that was for me. But I suppose I was always a little bit judgmental. It was kind of a natural choice. But what actually happened was that I was working as an attorney for a number of years, and I felt like something was lacking, that I wanted to do something a little bit more meaningful. And I always had, perhaps from my Jewish educational background, a strong passion for tzedek tirdo, for pursuing righteousness and justice. And after really getting burned out following 5 years of a practice in a law firm, I took a leave of absence, and I decided that I would join the Yadin Yadin program, the Jewish Jurisprudence program at Yeshiva University, not because I really ever expected to be a Jewish law judge, but during that year, I was asked to help out with the revitalization of the Beit Din of America, which is one of the country's largest rabbinical courts that had recently been reconstituted. And the person who had been serving as the director of the Beit Din at the conclusion of that year went back to his previous job as a law school professor, and there was nobody else left to be the director. So since I was the only one left in the office, I just changed the stationery and I made myself the director. And after that, somebody had to sit on the cases, so I started sitting as a judge.
Thank you. Also, again, by way of background, can you describe your daily responsibilities as a appellate judge or as a DIAN? What does your caseload look like? You address civil as well as criminal cases. Just general background like that. Thank you.
Oh. Okay.
The prerogative of a judge.
I guess not of a DIAN, but I have a multi-faceted docket. We hear a number of different cases. The cases that are heard in a Betin differ from that of a court insofar as we don't have automatic or primary jurisdiction. We only have jurisdiction if the parties actually sign an arbitration agreement and give over jurisdiction to us to decide their disputes. That being said, I hear three different types of disputes. Commercial disputes, matrimonial disputes, and communal disputes. The commercial disputes, it can range from a dispute about defective merchandise to a dispute about a failure to comply with a non-compete clause and whether it was enforceable in the first place, to a dispute regarding the arrangement between an employer and an employee regarding the salary and the bonus incentive package, and whether it was properly complied with. Those are just a few of the types of cases that I've heard in the last couple of months. Matrimonial cases have frequently a Jewish law component having to do with whether or not a Jewish divorce, a get, should be required or coerced from the party who's refusing to grant it or to accept it. But we also deal with custodial disputes regarding who should make decisions or have residential custody regarding the children, and also questions of how much child support should be paid as well. We also hear communal disputes, which are disputes within the Jewish community that have communal ramifications, such as when there's a major fight between a synagogue and its rabbi and they have a falling out, and the question is whether the rabbi should or shouldn't remain in the synagogue, and also questions of schools that have to downsize because of difficult financial times, and whether they should be required to offer severance packages to all of the faculty members and other employees whom they let go.
That was helpful. Jurisdiction is about as broad in the federal court as there is in any of the courts in the United States. We do civil and criminal cases, and the way I like to most easily describe it is we do everything but family law. So you're not going to be able to appeal whether or not you get the get in federal court. That won't happen. The type of cases that we do really have to do with jurisdiction in the first case. You know, there are certain requirements for whether a case can get into federal court. And of course, once they get into federal court, they deal with cases at the district court level. Then they go up to the Court of Appeals, and an infinitesimal number go to the Supreme Court of the United States. So we're what's called the Intermediate Court of Appeals. For the Third Circuit, which is the circuit that I'm involved in, we handle cases from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and the Virgin Islands. There are about 85 to 90 district court judges in those states in that one territory, and all of the appeals from those in that territory come up to the Court of Appeals and is handled by myself and my colleagues.
Thank you very much. This question relates actually to a lot of what Rabbi Reese said. The question is, to the extent that the cases that you just described, do they ever involve the substantive law of the other jurisdiction? So Rabbi Reese, how much do you have to deal with substantive American law in, for example, custody disputes or other aspects of enforceability? And Judge Greenaway, have you ever encountered a situation, either as an appellate judge or as a trial judge, in which you've had to examine substantive Jewish law, Talmudic law?
No, I haven't had that. And I'm trying to think of how it would come up. I suppose, yeah, I don't think so.
Have you ever encountered a case of enforcing an abasement decision?
No, I mean, we obviously, there have been times where there's something has come up with regard to foreign law. You know, do you apply literally the law of France or the law of England to a dispute that possibly arose there? You know, that could be an instance. But so far, no Talmudic law. But I'm looking forward to it.
One of the tricky things about Betin jurisdiction is that we really do operate as a arbitration tribunal within the context of the civil court system. So sometimes that requires us as a matter of public policy in order for the decisions to be enforceable to make sure that we decide certain types of disputes in a way that is consistent with civil law. So for example, if we're deciding a child support determination, we need to follow the child support standards guidelines that are promulgated by the state that the Beit Din is in. And if we're going to depart at all from those standards, then we need to explain what extraordinary circumstances motivated us to diverge from those standards in order to ensure the enforceability of our decision. Also, there's a Jewish law principle which states that dina d'malchus dina, that sometimes the law of the land is actually the Jewish law as well when it involves the matters of broad public policy monetary regulation. So for example, if a person is subject to bankruptcy, whatever the bankruptcy laws require become incorporated as part of Jewish law. We recently heard a case where two of the defendants became bankrupt. They declared bankruptcy in the middle of the proceeding, and as a result, although the entities that they owned could be subject to our proceeding, the parties themselves as individuals could not be subject to the proceeding because we needed to respect the automatic. There was one case of a landlord-tenant dispute where there was a Section 8 issue regarding exactly how much rent could be charged, and it was clear that one of the parties wanted to collect more than what they were allowed to collect according to Section 8 regulations based on a private deal between the parties, and we made it very clear to the parties that we had no ability or prerogative to override the civil law on this subject because it was a matter of public policy, and therefore our decision in terms of what we were able to enforce needed to be consistent with the civil law.
So just to follow up on that, and this is just a question for Rabbi Reis, you are both a lawyer and a dayan. Many judges of Beis Din, as far as I know, and you tell me, do they have to be both a civil lawyer and a dayan, and do you think your knowledge of both has helped you?
I think there's no question that my familiarity with both systems of law has been a tremendous asset for me personally in functioning as a dayan. I do think that in order for any rabbinical court to be able to serve the community effectively in this country, it is important that its members, or at least some of its members, have a familiarity and appreciation for the civil law system. This is why the rabbinical courts with which I have been affiliated have always had rabbis with tremendous erudition in Jewish law, but also rabbis who are lawyers who have a background in civil law as well. It's also important sometimes to bring people in from the outside. So for example, we sometimes have cases that implicate antitrust issues. Like for example, one pizza place wants to open up across the street from another pizza place, which is one of the most standard cookie cutter type of Beit Din cases. Because if they brought a case to stop another business from opening in civil court, they would be thrown out of court since we believe in free enterprise. So they'll go to a Beit Din, but even though the Beit Din does have certain rules about not infringing upon another person's business and taking away their livelihood, we have an obligation to comply with antitrust statutes. So whenever we hear a case of that sort, we always make sure that we bring in as one of the panelists of the Bet-Din an individual who just happens to be an antitrust partner at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, which is one of the most distinguished and reputable law firms in New York City, so that he can look over what the other Dayan and what the other rabbis are deciding to make sure that nothing in this, the decision would run afoul of antitrust statutes.
So now moving to enforceability of your decisions, and this is a question for Judge Greenaway. It has been said that it costs more to send a criminal to jail than it does to send them to Harvard Law School. Do you believe that the criminal justice system in this country is working effectively, and why? Does the jail system teach criminals how to function in society, or does it cause more crime by putting all criminals together? And the question for Rabbi Reis is, to the extent Talmudic law does not believe in jail, how does it create an effective deterrent? And to the extent that you're on Basin, or function as a Basin, how do you ensure enforceability of your decisions?
Okay. That was wonderful, and so here's a great piece of learning for you. Try not to ask a judge five questions. He only got three questions. I got five. In any case, so have you seen the bill for Harvard Law School lately? I don't know. I think it's more expensive to send him to Harvard Law School myself. So does the criminal justice system work effectively? Are we spending too much money on it? You know, you can teach an entire course on the questions that were just posed. So I think the way to look at, you know, the criminal justice system is to think about, you know, what's the genesis of the way we think about law generally and crime. So crime was always thought of as a problem that arose within the community and the community should address it, right? So once you step out of that sort of community notion, you need some uniformity in how you deal with crime so that you don't have instances where if somebody steals this very nice pen that I have, in one community they lose a hand and in another community someone says, please don't do that again. And it's in that seeking of uniformity that you have problems. You know, you've heard in the news about certain ways in which different societies address different crimes. And there's always an outcry in the news as to how we address particular crimes. This judge was too lenient in a sentence on this particular crime, or this judge was too harsh in another, and it's something that we as a society in America are always grappling with. You know, what is the community's position, view, outrage with regard to a particular act? How should we react to it? What's the right balance? Which is why I think that the system generally works, because everyone is not going to be happy with every decision. And we do have, at least federally, a way to try to address different crimes committed in different communities uniformly. It used to be, until the sentencing guidelines came into effect in November of 87, that you could literally have someone, now forget about jurisdiction for a moment, you could literally have somebody steal a bottle of water in the South and get a year in jail, and steal that same bottle of water in New York and get probation. And obviously you spin that out into other crimes like robbery or burglary. And it's that kind of focus on, you know, what's fair, how can we address crime, what should we be looking at when we talk about sort of retribution, because to a certain extent the criminal law system is how do we express society's outrage at particular acts that individuals engage in? You know, that's what criminal law is about. So any notion of, is the system working, is it fair, has to take that into account. Now, are we sending too many people to jail? Is jail effective? There are certain crimes that are committed that say to society, that person has forfeited the right to live among us. And I'm okay with that. And some people forfeit their rights to live among us for the rest of their lives. And I'm also okay with that. The death penalty is an entirely different discussion, which we don't have enough time to get into. But I think those are some at least introductory thoughts about the criminal justice system.
Well, I guess one good thing for me is that after the temple was destroyed, rabbinical courts no longer enjoy criminal jurisdiction, so I don't really have to worry about the issue. One thing I do have to worry about is to make sure that parties don't trick us into taking a criminal case into our court when it really belongs in the criminal court. And we are very vigilant, for example, about identifying those cases and making sure that when the party should be going to the police, as opposed to the rabbis, we send them to the police. Sometimes I wish I could throw the parties into jail, but it's just not my prerogative. What we do in order to ensure that the decisions are enforceable is that we have the parties sign a binding arbitration agreement, and then once they do that and we have jurisdiction over their civil disputes, once we issue our decision is as enforceable in the regular courts as any judgment that would be handed down by a civil court of competent jurisdiction. And Jewish law has always believed in this partnership. That's what the Bible says, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha. You should have judges and you should have police officers. You need to have police officers, enforcement agents who can carry out the decisions of the Beit Din and compel the parties to do what the Beit Din has mandated. So in that sense, we utilize the civil court all the time, insofar as parties who have received judgment in the Beit Din will enter those judgments in the civil court, and then the civil court will empower a sheriff to collect the judgments, to marshal a person's assets and garnish their wages and do whatever else is necessary, even if it's a judgment of millions of dollars. I did have one case where we utilized the jail system, and that was a case where we had required a man to give a get. But we didn't have the power to throw him into jail, but the Israeli rabbinical courts do. And the man just happened to have family in Israel, so he ran off to Israel to escape his wife here and to find a safe harbor there. Little did he realize that we would contact the rabbinical courts in Israel, and we shared our judgment with them, and they promptly threw the guy into jail, and within a couple of days he had given his wife a gift.
Just to follow up on not that last story, but on the earlier idea that is there any issue? This is a question for Rabbi Reese with Masira of handing when you have to deal with jail of giving over someone who you think is worthy of jail to civil authority.
I don't want to get myself into trouble with Judge Greenaway, so I'll try to answer the question cautiously. Well. The truth of the matter is that there are differing opinions among the rabbis on this particular subject, but I think that the mainstream opinion is the one that was articulated by the famous commentator, the Aruch HaShulchan, about 100 years ago, who was a rabbinical figure in Lithuania, and this was also echoed by Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who is a prominent rabbinic authority who lived in Israel and just passed away recently, and that is that the whole prohibition discussed in Talmudic sources of handing somebody over to governmental officials was only speaking about unjust governments that unfairly discriminated against Jews. But when you're living in a just government, which according to the Aruch HaShulchan included Tsarist Russia, so it certainly would include the United States, then there really is no prohibition as long as the person really committed the crime and deserves to be punished.
All right, now following the directions, keep my question simple. what is the most difficult legal case that you've had to decide?
That was a really good question. There was only one. That's great. The fun part of being a judge is that really, for me, every day there are interesting issues that come up that have to be resolved. And the difficulty comes in putting your prejudice aside, right? So all of us that sit here have different prejudices, right? It could be with regard to food, it could be with regard to people, it could be with regard to, you know, color preferences. I mean, like, you know, gray, you know, for instance. And when you think about that, it's making sure that you're always fair, making sure that you listen to both sides, really listen to the arguments that they make. Law is endlessly fascinating for me, because that desire to be fair and equitable, which, you know, emanates obviously from our sort of religious study and religious study of history, et cetera, really comes into play every day in the law. So I can't tell you, you know, this one case is the most difficult case that I've ever had, but I can tell you a moment that I remember. I was a district court judge, and I had been a district court judge for about maybe 6 or 7 months. And I was involved in a trial that ultimately would take about 2 months. And it was about leather tanning. You know, those of you whose parents have like a leather sofa or whatever, there's certain chemicals and formulas that go into tanning the leather to a particular color and particular specifications. So basically, it's a case that involves, you know, chemistry, some physics, and, you know, my parents wanted me to be a doctor. I chose to be a lawyer. There was a reason. I would have been an okay doctor. I'm a much better lawyer. So I'm sitting there, and I remember having this moment of sort of looking down at the book. The parties didn't know I was really praying for inspiration, because I was like, this is really hard, you know, and I don't know how I'm going to come to a decision. Well, divine inspiration did come, and I did come to that decision that day, and many days after that. You know, you meet the same conundrum. You all meet it now in your educational pursuits. There are times when you say, oh my gosh, this is so hard, and then you make it through. The same thing is true in the law, but it's because it's with regard to every case that you think, how can I be my best to be fair and equitable? And when you do that, then even the more difficult cases that take some time to ferret out can be reached, and you can reach a good decision that you can live with. I sleep like a baby every night. I never worry about cases.
Well, I also never worry about cases, because fortunately I forget them all immediately after I issue the decision. It's a special skill that I developed over the years, and that God gave us the gift to forget things, and you have to know when to utilize it. So people come to me years later and say, do you remember me when I was in front of the Beth Din? And I truthfully don't remember a soul. So it's really just very, very blissful. But in terms of difficult cases, I mean, I'll just state a general statement, which I think is along the lines of what Judge Greenaway was saying, but it's very important, which is that really every single case is just as difficult and just as easy as every other case. And it's very important for a judge to realize when a case appears easy that it's actually much more difficult, and that it's subject to its own unique circumstances. And if it seems easy, it means that you have to think much more harder about it before you render the decision. And so too, when a case seems really, really difficult, it's important for the judge to realize that there is precedent, there is the ability to get help, there's the possibility of making sure that there are experts and testify before the court for in areas that the judges know less about, and that every single difficult case can be made manageable as well. But if you feel that it's way too difficult at the time you're rendering the decision, then you're rendering the decision too early. But I will tell you the one case that I found to be the most difficult, but it had nothing to do with an arbitration. It had to do with simply a Jewish law determination. So I'll get a little bit into the religious realm and maybe the supernatural realm. So I had a case in which we had to make a determination about the legitimacy of a particular child, because this child was born to a woman who had remarried without receiving a get from her first husband, which would make the child illegitimate. and that the child was brought up semi-traditional, was now becoming deeply religious, and if the child would be illegitimate, they wouldn't be able to marry within the traditional community, and that would have been catastrophic for the child's life. So we try to find some sort of an argument or dispensation to enable this child to be declared legitimate. The first avenue was to try to invalidate the mother's first marriage, but it turned out that the mother had a nice Orthodox Jewish marriage and everything seemed perfectly fine and perfectly flawless. So I searched and I searched and I searched for ways to find problems with the first marriage or to otherwise find a tenuous Jewish law argument which would enable the child to be declared legitimate, and I could not come up with anything. And then one night I went to sleep and I had a dream. And in my dream, in the middle of the night, the great sage, who then was still alive, although an older man, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, appeared to me in the dream. And Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who was one of the most distinguished and respected Jewish law authorities in the world, he lived in Israel, and he said to me in the dream, "Don't worry about it, just write up all your arguments and send it to me." So the next day I came to the office, I wrote up all my arguments, I sent it to Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, and he ruled that my arguments were acceptable and the child should be deemed legitimate.
I like that.
I like that story. Have you ever encountered a situation where you felt there was no precedent for the legal question you were facing? And if so, how did you approach ingenuity within the law?
Well, I know what I'm going to do now. I'm going to dream more. all right, no precedent. Well, you're talking about the most exciting thing for a judge, right? It's called first impression. Why is it so exciting? Because it means you get to make something up. Now, you all haven't done that since you were probably a lot smaller and playing pretend with each other. But as a judge, it's exciting because a case of first impression requires you to really draw on all of your experience, which is exciting for me. I hope it's exciting for my colleagues. You know, when you think about a case, and it's only happened to me a few times, where literally nothing has been written about a particular situation. And the excitement is that you get to think about instances, how do I draw an analogy to another situation that might be helpful? How do I look at cases that aren't on all fours exactly alike, but I could make arguments? Or how do you come up with all of the arguments that the rabbi came up with that seem to make sense, but there is no precedent for? Well, sometimes you just make those arguments, and it sticks, and it works. Precedent is a really interesting way of looking at the law, and I know that, well, I don't know. I presume, maybe to my detriment, the rabbi will tell me, that precedent is very important in Jewish law as well. Because law is foundational. We can't just sort of make something up over here and make something up over there. Everything is built on a foundation. And I think that the law that we deal with in federal court is no different. We have to think about it foundationally. So those instances where you literally have something that's a matter of first impression is really interesting. It's the most interesting.
Benefit in this sense of Jewish law is that while a precedent is considered to be useful, it's actually not completely binding, and one does have the ability to overrule precedent, but you do it at your own peril. You're likely going to be subject to a lot of criticism if you go against most of the earlier authorities. There's a certain precedent if something is clear in the Talmud that one cannot violate, but if there are decisions in the last 100 or 200 years, it certainly is within the prerogative of a Beit Din to come up with a different approach. But it's also the case that since Jewish law has been around for so many thousands of years, just when you think that you have a new, exciting case of first impression that nobody has thought of before, it turns out that there actually usually ends up being some sort of precedent. I remember I had some convoluted case regarding not leather seats, but plastic bags, where there was some plastic bag manufacturer that that produced the bags and sent it to a vendor, and the vendor sent it to its customer, and the one who arranged it never even saw the bags, and it turned out that the bags were defective, and the one who supplied it said, well, you knew that I never looked at it, you should have looked at it before you used it, and the other party said, but you're ultimately responsible, and the whole thing involved so many different parties that it felt like there was no way in the world I would ever find any rabbinic authority who dealt with such a convoluted case. And I found a case that was 100% directly on point from Rabbi Shlomo Shwadran, the Maharsham, from 120 years ago, and I was able to just follow his approach to the letter, which was perfectly reasonable under the circumstances. But the case that really just shocked me the most was when I had two parties who walked in. One of them was a broker who arranged the contract for the other party. They had some sort of a software business, and he arranged the contract with the state, party therefore made some money by getting the contract, and the other party had to pay the broker a certain fee. But in the course of arranging the contract, the broker had to hire another employee. And the broker said, well, the cost of the employee is something that we should bear because it's not something that we told you that you should have to pay. And the other party said, no, you wouldn't have gotten the contract for us if you hadn't hired that employee, and therefore we should have to pay for the employee. And we're all just sitting there, kind of like pinching ourselves, figuring that, you know, this must be like this incredible dream, but it turned out that this really, really happened. And we thought, it's got to be that nothing like this ever happened before. And then it turned out that there's a story in the Jerusalem Talmud like this, where Alexander the Great wandered upon some African kingdom, and he found that they were deciding a case, and the case was somebody had sold a field to a purchaser, and the purchaser found a treasure chest in the field. And the purchaser said, the treasure chest belongs to you, because you didn't intend to sell me the treasure chest, just the field. And the seller said, no, the treasure chest belongs to you, because I sold you the field and everything that's in it. So, and the king, under the circumstances, asked the seller, do you have a son? He said, yeah. And he asked the purchaser, do you have a daughter? He said, yeah. So he said, I have first the perfect solution. Have your son marry the other one's daughter, and the two of them will split the treasure chest together. And Alexander the Great looked at this, and he just started laughing. And the other king said, why are you laughing? And Alexander the Great said, had the case come in front of me, I would have killed them both and kept all the money for myself. But at least we understood that there was some sort of a precedent, and we were able to work on that basis.
Okay, so now moving on to the decision-making process. At this point in your career, Judge Greenaway, as an appellate judge, you have to decide cases with other judges, and Rabbi Reese, you decide cases with other dayanim. Can you explain the process by which you go about making a decision? Do you first each independently come to your own decision and then discuss it with your colleagues, or do you first debate it with your colleagues and then come to some collective decision?
So now you know, you want to know how it's all made up, huh? What's the secret behind the curtain? What's the wizard doing? So the answer is, at least from our perspective, a little bit of everything that was mentioned, right? So generally speaking, on the appellate level, a case comes in, let's say 30 cases come in for a sitting, and a sitting is just the term used for when we sit to hear cases. We split those cases up 10 apiece. So let's say it's the three of us. Each of us will be responsible for a particular case, but we all are responsible for reading all 30 cases and deciding which of them requires special attention, which of them requires what we call oral argument, that is, appearing before the three-judge panel and making your arguments. We sometimes send memos to each other by email beforehand. I'm troubled by this, I'm troubled by that. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? I'd say 95% of the time, we don't discuss the case beforehand at all. So myself and whichever clerk in my office is working on a particular case, we'll read the papers, we'll discuss the case. What do we think should be the resolution? Why? What are the what the case law implicated? Has the Supreme Court said anything on this matter? Has another panel of our court, the Third Circuit, said anything? Have other circuit courts said anything? What have they said? How long ago was it? I don't envy the rabbi, because if I went back 120 years, it would be like an act of desperation that nothing has at all happened in the area that we're talking about. And frankly, there are very few judges that are revered from 120 years ago that we'd follow. In federal court, it's very much recency that rules. If something is a precedent from when I was in law school, which doesn't seem that long ago, but looking at your faces, since none of you were alive when I was in law school, apparently it was a long time ago. You know, if you're using a case from 35 years ago, it's like, oh my God, you know, can't you find anything more recent than that? So the manner in which the case goes along is we study and then we come together, we hear oral argument, and then we discuss it generally. And then during that discussion, that's when we really make the decision on how we're going to rule. And what's really interesting is, in a way that isn't replicated in many other instances, you can have a pure discussion about law. Now, the Supreme Court seems very politicized, and yes, it is. But at our level, people really don't vote according to their political party. I happen to be a Democrat. I don't have to seek out other Democrats to get votes. There are a lot of times that I agree with my Republican colleagues on many issues, and vice versa. So it's a fascinating process, because it is sort of a discussion of law qua law in a really pure environment that isn't charged by the many different aspects and considerations that it would appear that the discussion about law is charged with when you're looking at the Supreme Court.
I guess Jewish law is a little bit different in this sense, because if I find the precedent that's 100 years old, and my colleague finds a precedent that's 300 years old, and the third panelist finds a precedent that's 500 years old, it's likely the third panelist who's going to have the say on the decision. Because in Jewish law, the more authentic that something is demonstrated to be by a virtue of its long and proud history, the more sound and the more authoritative it's going to be deemed by a judicial panel. That being said, we don't generally sit and argue about the force and the strength of our precedents. But we try to collectively reach an understanding of what are the appropriate precedents and also what's the appropriate approach in this case. Usually the conversation consists of two different elements. One is a discussion of how we understand the facts of the case, and the second is how we understand that the facts should apply to the law, should apply to the facts of the case. After we reach a general consensus, which is a give and take, it's generally decided that one of the panelists will take the first stab at writing the decision for everybody. And then after the draft is prepared, everybody else looks at the draft, they comment upon the draft, and sometimes there are even wholesale changes that are made after the draft. But what I have sometimes seen, which I think is a much poorer process, is for there simply to be a peripheral discussion and then a decision to assign the decision to one judge, who essentially decides the case by virtue of the fact that he's the one taking the time to write it, and then the others simply make minor editorial comments because this wasn't their case. That, I think, is the wrong approach, and that's not the reason why we have three judges. We have three judges so that each one will weigh in equally, and therefore I am a very strong proponent of the process of having all of the judges confer at great length before anybody takes the time to write a draft decision.
This is actually a question for Judge Greenaway about the appellate process and the rationale behind appeals. Is it effective or efficient to have the appeal system an entire second trial? Why not have the three judges who are experienced appellate judges but have them at the trial court level. Why have the appeal system?
You know, when you had that, when you sent me that question, I didn't understand it. Now I understand it. Now, having heard what the rabbi does, and understanding a little better, I'm going to learn a lot more before the night is over on how the Jewish court functions. So, in defense of the American system, however you want to describe it, the federal system, I think that you know, when you think about due process, the Constitution, and you know, the notion of judging, you know, throughout the Torah, throughout the rest of the Bible, there are always instances of wise men and women, mostly men. Happens to that way, but you know, the mostly women now. Coming to decisions that are based on a consideration of all of the facts. And those decisions are generally based on notions of equity and fairness. One of the keys to that with regard to having a trial system as well as an appellate system is taking into account the human error of the decision maker. So when we have trials, there are decisions that are made that affect the ultimate determination by the judge, and there are decisions, obviously the verdict, made by the jury. Those decisions can be influenced by things other than fairness and equity. And I think that it's, or they could just get it wrong. And I think that it's that notion that really requires an appellate system. When you look at the founding fathers and the formation of the government, the thought about the Constitution, there was always a thought of an ultimate court called the Supreme Court that would be free from the political considerations that the legislature would be part of and that the president would be a part of. And I think that when you look at the trial process and the appellate process, you need those two, and in the federal system, three bites at the apple. It's, I think, certainly possible to get it all right the first time. If I could rely on precedent 500 years old, I'd probably get it right most of the time as well. But I think that, you know, that's part, at least from my consideration, of the beauty of the system. The fact that if a decision is the right decision, it will hold up under review by others. That's the way to think about it. Think about a very politically charged issue, the death penalty. We know much more about the death penalty, and Barry Sheck, who's at Cardozo, anybody hear of Barry Sheck? You will soon, those of you that go to Cardozo Law School, which I also teach at, little plug for Cardozo. That's the Innocence Project was started at the Cardozo Law School. The reason I bring it up is because there are time after time we learn that there is inequity in the process and there are mistakes made. People who are on death row really didn't do it. And if there were just one bite at the apple, one opportunity for them to prove their case, they might be lost and give the ultimate price. So I like our system. I think it's an equitable system, not that the other system's not, but I think that there really is a need for an appellate process.
Okay, so I think that just to clarify for the record, in Jewish law, there certainly is not the attitude that we do get it right the first time, but we certainly try to get it right the first time. There's
but you got to get it right
absolutely. Let me clarify that as well. In the arbitration court system, as a general rule, the arbitrator's decision is not appealable. The decision, once it's rendered, is final. However, an arbitration court can choose to have an appeals process. And in fact, the rabbinical course with which I am associated all have appeals processes which are built in, because it's a recognition, already going back to Talmudic times, that judges are not infallible. That even judges, although they try their best to get things right, try their best to review the existing law and changes that have been made in the law over time, and to apply all of those considerations to a reasoned and proper judgment, may still make fundamental errors. And therefore, there was always a notion of having a higher court that could review the decisions of the lower court. And in fact, that takes place all the time. As a matter of course, parties will appeal a decision that was rendered by the first rabbinical court to hear the case. And if there is an obvious and glaring error, then the higher court or higher authority, often it's the chief rabbinical judge of the court, will adjust or modify or completely overrule a previously rendered decision. It's very important in any judicial system to have a set of checks and balances in order to ensure that justice is properly served.
Now, as judges, what do you think is the public perception of both the American court system and the Basin decisions, and how would you go about improving the public perception of the accuracy of American court decisions or Basin decisions?
So I have two responses. One is sort of an empirical, anecdotal response, and one is a perception based on, you know, what I see, read, and hear. So people's reaction to me when they find out I'm a judge is, at the beginning, it's always a little weird, because it's almost like this reverence that seems a little weird. You know, it's like, judge, you know, and they start the shaking of the head, and you know, the bowing and this and that, and it's a little weird, but I've come to like it. So I think there's this whole notion of reverence, and it's obviously reverence for the position, and for the fact that. It's, you know, it's a very serious position, and it's an important part of sort of our makeup. Now, lawyers, as a general matter, get beat up in the press quite a bit. But I have found that I don't get as many lawyer jokes since I've become a judge. I don't know why that is. But I suppose to a certain extent that's public perception. I think that the more interesting question is, as Adina posed it, what is it that we as judges can do to elevate the public perception of the process, the decision-making process that we engage in on a daily basis? And part of that is, you know, what we're doing here today. I mean, I'm learning a lot. Because I didn't know anything about, you know, the Jewish law court.
I'm making it all up.
Right, but it sounds very convincing. But I'm learning a lot today, and it's one of the reasons that I love doing forums like this, because I always find I come to them and I learn. I'm hoping that you all are learning some things as well, and I think that it's part of the obligation of judges to talk about their decision-making process, because it shouldn't be, you know, I alluded to the Wizard of Oz, it shouldn't be, you know, we go into a room and, you know, we talk about the law, and you're not worthy to talk about the law. So it should be an open process in which you understand what precedent is, you know, why we come to the decisions that we make, and it's why everything that we do as judges is public. You know, obviously you're not in on the conferences where we discuss the cases, but the result of those conferences are opinions which are made public to all and available to all. And if people don't like the reasoning and the rationale behind our decision-making, it's there in the public. to be criticized, which I think is critical to an open and fair society. So I think that whatever we as judges can do to demystify the process and to make sure that the public has greater access to it is important.
I really couldn't agree more with what Judge Greenaway says. I think that every single court and every single rabbinical court, by extension, really earns its reputation through its own internal integrity. And that integrity is manifested through having open and transparent processes, by having published procedures, by clarifying ahead of time expectations, and by having accountability. And even though, as a matter of strict arbitration law, it's not necessary for arbitrators sitting in an arbitration tribunal to spell out the reasons for their decision, in the rabbinical court world, we insist, really, as a matter of course, on always spelling out all of the precedents and all of the arguments and all of the assumptions behind our decisions, so that it will be clear that it's not just some hocus-pocus process, and that everything is carefully considered, and if parties want to appeal based on the decision-making argumentation, they have the right to do so, and that they can understand exactly what went into the deliberations of the judges in reaching their decision. In fact, in this sense, the rabbinical courts are somewhat hampered compared to the civil court system, because we don't have the ability to automatically publish all of our decisions. One of the expectations of the parties when they go to any arbitration tribunal is the expectation of confidentiality, that the case and the dispute and the decision will not be broadcast to the public. On the other hand, we feel that while there's transparency with respect to the parties, we want the broader world to know about the decision-making process of the Beit Din as well. So what the Beit Din of America actually has started doing recently is anonymizing its various decisions, so that the parties' names are taken out, or some of the facts are changed. And then in that anonymized or redacted form, the decisions are being published through various journals that are being issued by the Beit Din. And even after the names are changed and the facts are changed a little bit, the cleaned up version is actually sent to the parties as well, as an extra measure of insurance for the parties to sign off that they are comfortable with this redacted version before it is published. But I feel that the more that this can be done, the more this can bolster the reputation of the court, because it is important as much as possible to have absolute transparency.
So last question, just before I open it up in case anyone has questions from the audience. You mentioned the role of lawyers. And this is an area where I believe the Beit Din process differs from the American process. So if you can discuss what is the role of lawyers and why do you view it as a necessity or why do you view it as not a necessity in your decision making? Or is it a necessary evil?
So, you know, just to take a step back and talk again for a second about the public perception of lawyers. You know, the public, I think, articulates a perception of lawyers that lawyers get in the way of justice, right? And it's because the public has a visceral reaction, mostly in criminal law, about what should happen in particular instances. And the way we present news these days really feeds into that, which is, I'm going to give you 20 seconds of facts, and I want you to come to a decision about a particular situation based on that 20 seconds, right? That's what the news is about, right? Lawyers are necessary because in your everyday life, you don't want people to make decisions about you in 20-second increments, right? So that would mean, I don't like your blouse, so you must be an idiot, right? Or those are terrible shoes, so you're a schmuck, whatever. Right? We don't make decisions like that. We can't. And in the law, we definitely can't. Lawyers are necessary because any kind of serious discussion of issues that are important to us societally have to be aired out, right? Lawyers help that process. They're critical to that process. Are all lawyers created equal? Obviously not. Those that go to Cardozo are superior, because they're taught by wonderful people. You teach at Cardozo, right? The point is that you know, lawyer bashing is very easy because lawyers are visible. But if there's going to continue to be a civil discussion in our society about the themes that that we've both been talking about, fairness and equity, right? There has to be someone to articulate them in more than 20-second bites. That's why lawyers are important, so that when there's an injustice done and someone spends 30 years on death row and then we find out that they didn't do it. How about, has everybody heard about the Central Park jogger case? No? Really? Can I do like 30 seconds on that? So the Central Park jogger case was a case, I guess, about 27 years ago, something like that, somewhere around there, where there was a young lady who unfortunately was jogging in the evening through Central Park. And there were five youths scooped up shortly after she reported that she'd been attacked. And it was a brutal attack. I mean, you know, she was severely hurt in the hospital for a long time. It was really very nasty. But, you know, kudos to the cops, so we thought at the time, because in a miraculously short amount of time, like minutes, not hours, they captured the five guys who had perpetrated this terrible thing. And they were quickly run through the system. Apparently they had confessed, so they must have done it, because, of course, why would the cops coerce a confession from people who, in fact, admitted their guilt immediately? And they spent the next 19 years in jail. Ah, there's a problem. None of them did it. In fact, they were coerced. In fact, the DNA showed that they should have been exonerated years ago, and now they are reaping monetary benefits that each of them would say, give me my 20 years back or 27 years back. I mean, can you just think about it? Everyone here is either in their teens or their 20s. I mean, students, that is. Now, suppose I told you that you would lose the next 22 years of your life, and at the end of that, you'd get a lot of money, but that you'd go through the worst experience that you could ever go through. You'd be told when you can do the most basic of human functions. You couldn't read what you wanted to read. You couldn't see your family when you wanted to see your family. You couldn't practice your religion the way that you want to practice your religion at the times and in the ways that you want to do that. Would anybody choose to make that choice? Any among you, would any among you choose to give up 20-something 20-something years, she's only teasing, 20-something years of your life for that? No. Who's responsible for the fact that these men have been vindicated? Lawyers. So whatever your perspective ultimately is on lawyers, they are an integral part of our society. And if you choose to go into law, I think it's a noble profession, and you can do real good to our society generally and to individuals in particular.
Well, I agree with that as well. I actually recommend for your viewing, there's a very powerful documentary on the Central Park 5, I think it's called, if you can get a hold of the video, the DVD, whatever. I would actually describe it as required viewing. It's very, very powerful. You won't think about law enforcement the same after you watch that video. I assume the judge has seen it. I think that lawyers, according to the Jewish law system, are necessary for two reasons. First of all, if we didn't allow lawyers, then our decisions wouldn't be enforceable. Because under arbitration law, there's a requirement that you have to allow the parties to be represented by counsel. Secondly, from a Jewish law perspective, there are really two competing considerations. One consideration is that the Mishnah, this is a piece of rabbinic literature going back 2,000 years, so it's very authoritative. The Mishnah says, "Al tas atzmecha korachei adayonim," don't act like lawyers, which sounds a little bit like it's not necessarily such a good thing to be a lawyer. On the other hand, the Talmud says, "Psach picha li'ilei." This is actually based on a biblical verse, which goes back even further, that you have to open up the mouths of those who are otherwise mute. And the commentators say that we have to strike a balance between these two competing considerations. On the one hand, it's important the parties have proper representation so that they can express themselves clearly and coherently so that the judges can properly adjudicate the case. On the other hand, what is discouraged is the notion of judges utilizing the law or their lawyerly abilities to bring about a perversion of justice, to take advantage of the vulnerable and the disadvantaged in society, and to exploit their weaknesses with their legal sophistry. That is something that is discouraged according to the Jewish law sources. And as a result, what is favored by the rabbinical courts is to have the parties be represented by individuals who are not going to pervert justice or not going to prolong a dispute. It otherwise could peacefully be resolved between the parties, but who can help the parties cogently present their cases before the rabbinical court. And in that sense, having lawyers who are duly licensed, who are subject to an ethical code for which they can be disciplined if they violate it, falls within the category of that which is deemed to be appropriate and even encouraged according to Jewish law.
All right, thank you very much. I want to know if anyone else in the audience has questions.
Hi, I'm Lizzie. First of all, thank you both so much for coming today. I really appreciate it. So my question is, have you ever had a case where you had to judge one way, but either morally or emotionally you wanted to judge another way? And if so, how did you deal with that?
Oh, that's okay. You can leave that. if I can't speak loudly enough for folks in the back to hear, I need to get a new profession. All right. So I think that doesn't happen often, but it does happen. I had a case, you talk about difficult cases. I had a case called Iwanoa versus the Ford Motor Company and the German subsidiary called Ford Werke. And it involved forced labor during World War II, and it was an attempt to try to get remuneration for people who were forced into slave labor. They worked at Ford plants during World War II, mostly building trucks for the Reich, and it was the plaintiffs were both Jews and non-Jews, because basically everybody who had laid in wake of the German Reich was forced into these types of situations. And viscerally, you hear something like that, and you go, okay, the plaintiffs have to win, and let's get them as much money as possible. That's your visceral reaction is sort of as a human being to human suffering. But every which way I looked, there was no way for it to work. There were statute of limitations problems. There were treaty problems. Most of the Allied countries had engaged in treaty negotiations because at the end of World War II, there literally was no Germany, right? So as a vanquished nation, there was no infrastructure to try to address a claim like this. They really didn't sort of rebuild their court system until almost the mid-50s. So, you know, that was a problem. And then what law do you apply? Do you apply German law? Do you apply U.S. law? Do you apply some sort of international law notions? So there were so many impediments that, and I had no 500-year precedent to rely on. So yeah, that was clearly an instance, at least for me, where I wanted to rule, but you know I felt restricted, and I should be restricted, right? Or constricted, I should say, because you know the development of law can't be about the visceral, right? Because the visceral will change. If any of you were judges, you might say, you know what? Forget about the law. I'm going to find a way for this to happen, and that's what leads to the breakdown of law, right? So law has to have internal consistency, and it has to be logical, and it has to hold up under scrutiny. If it doesn't hold up under scrutiny, there's no reason to follow it. The reason that we all follow the law, other than the fact that we don't want to go to jail and get hit over the head, and other bad things that might happen, is that at least in the instances that are most obvious to society generally, law makes sense, right? It seems logical. It seems logical that I should not, you know, lay a hand on the professor, right? We can all agree on that, right? and it seems logical that if I did, right, that would be bad, right? We'd all say that would be bad, and that society should do something about that, right? So that's obviously a simple example, but that's why the law works, and that's generally why we societally adhere to the law. So those kind of difficult cases don't come up all the time, but it's the reason that you want judges, and I, the selection process in federal court is political. But one of the things that the founding fathers in particular, Alexander Hamilton, talked about in something called the Federalist Papers, any of you who are poli-sci junkies, the Federalist Papers talked about is the way to make judges independent is to give them tenure, so they're not worried about the political in their decision making. If I was worried about the political in my decision making, I might have tried to come up with a way to make that work, right, for the plaintiffs that I told you about. But so that's one of the beauties of lifetime tenure. I didn't. So, sorry, that was a long answer to your question.
All right. Thank you.